Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well will be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ask the Blood Detective. My name is Dr. Michael Wald, and I'm the supervisor of nutritional services at an integrated nutrition and health and wellness center located in Mount Kisco, New York, known as Integrated Nutrition. I've been practicing holistic health and nutrition, disease prevention, disease treatment for nearly 27 years. And I can tell you, in all that time, I've seen quite a lot. As far as health is concerned and our approaches to disease prevention, what I've seen is that you, the public, make great attempts all by yourself to figure out how to eat, how to live, including exercise, of course, stress reduction, various lifestyle measures, which also often include the use of specialty diets and the use of hundreds of different forms of nutritional supplements. And most of the time, your source of information is either what you hear from other individuals, which is not necessarily bad, and also what you might find on the web. My experience has taught me that most of the information and knowledge that you might possess now does not come from necessarily the most reputable sources, nor is that information necessarily what is called evidence-based. Now, evidence-based is a term used in scientific circles to describe the level to which either a diet or a food or some nutritional compound, whether it be a vitamin, a mineral, or herb, for example, has gone through rigorous scientific exploration into whatever the intended or claimed potential is of that food or nutrient. So, for example, if you hear that vitamin E might be beneficial for coronary artery disease, then we would hope, at least I would hope, as a healthcare professional interested in only using those things that are well studied and taken correctly. So in the case of vitamin E, there are literally hundreds of scientific studies that have proven its use in both the prevention and even in the treatment of various forms of cardiovascular disease, such as the lowering of cholesterol or the softening of arteries or of the thinning of blood. So vitamin E is a blood thinner at a certain level in some individuals. I should step back for a moment and review a few basic fundamentals of the use of nutrients. And today's topic, by the way, is actually a review of the use of herbs, what we call botanicals or even phytonutrients. And when I discuss them today, I'll also interject quite a bit about diet and vitamins and minerals, because it's vitamins and minerals and herbs or botanicals that seem to be the major players that most individuals, possibly like you out there in the public, use to improve your health. Now, I was mentioning just a little while ago that most of the information that I have seen patients bring to at my consultation table when we are talking about their health, that knowledge that's gained is not from reputable scientific sources. There are two major sources of evidence-based or scientific literature that at least healthcare providers use, but it's also open to the public, and they're known as the Cochrane Medical Database and the National Library of Medicine. So the National Library of Medicine can be found on PubMed.com. That's publishedmedicalarticles.com. When you go to a search engine like this, you've really got some access to reliable, scientific, evidence-based information. Now, maybe some of you think that's overkill and you don't need to know that. You just need to know what works. Well, I understand that as well. But there's a problem, or I should say that there is a concern that I have that some individuals will take certain nutritional compounds for whatever the health problem. Again, eczema, migraines, gastrointestinal problems like inflammatory bowel disease, maybe colon cancer, maybe breast cancer, maybe brain cancer, multiple sclerosis. I'm just rattling off some of the conditions I've managed just in the last 2 weeks. And because an individual senses an improvement when they take something, they believe that that something is working or can work in the ways that it's purported to work. What I'm trying to distinguish here is that there is a difference often, sometimes a big difference between something working and something that seems to be working in the short term. For example, yesterday I was in the office and I received a phone call from a patient who said that she was experiencing bruising all over her body and she believed it was from the omega-3 fatty acids that she was taking, or fish oil. Now, some of you might have heard that fish oil is a potential blood thinner. Now, notice I said the word potential, because the doses or amounts of fish oil that a person would need to take to actually get blood thinning happening will take grams and grams, meaning thousands and thousands of milligrams. It's also not even guaranteed they'd ever experience any effects on blood thinning. Not to say that within 2 days of taking it, this particular patient should experience bruising. It takes several weeks to get to what are known as therapeutic blood levels. And again, a person would have to take an awful lot of omega-3 oils for this sort of effect to happen. Now, I asked her to take some photos of these areas of her skin where she claimed that were bruised, and she did. And in one of those pictures, I saw a bruise. I did not see a bruise in any other areas. I asked her to come in because I thought maybe there was some issue with with the photography. And I did not see any bruising. And when I said to her I did not see it, she just stared at me. So she somehow imagined that she was bruising all over the place and had one small bruise and connected it to her knowledge about what omega-3 fats can do. I'm bringing up this story because very, very often there is a strong psychological influence upon how people think their nutrients are working. They'll do some research, they'll take that nutritional compound. In this case, we were talking about omega-3 fats, but it could have been vitamin C and it could have been vitamin E, for example, or even ginkgo biloba. And sometimes people put these together and imagine effects. The only way to really get around imagined effects versus real effects are to take a look at what is claimed. In other words, someone saying, yes, I started to take magnesium and my headaches went away. I started to take zinc and immediately I felt that my immune system was stronger, is to look at, in some cases, the blood levels of some of these nutrients. In other cases, it does matter what an individual is saying. If you say to me, I feel better when I take this, but if you've only taken it 1 day, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 days, depending on the supplement, it could take a lot longer just to reach what are known as therapeutic blood levels. When you take a supplement, it doesn't necessarily all get into your bloodstream. And therefore, if it doesn't get into the bloodstream, it cannot necessarily make it to the organs and tissues and organ systems in need. First, let's trace for a moment the pathway that a vitamin, mineral, or an herbs which will be the main focus of today's topic, get to the tissues that you need them to. And it's not going to take long. This will just take a minute to describe. It's pretty fundamental and basic on the surface, but there's a lot more to nutrient absorption than what I'll be talking about now. I would direct you to another one of my Ask the Blood Detective shows on nutrient absorption and activation. You can find all of those on my blog, and the blog is at info@blooddetective.com. Now, that blooddetective.com website has the blog with all of the shows, and that website will also lead you to my main office website of Integrated Nutrition. So basically, you take a nutritional supplement in the form of a pill, a capsule, or a liquid, for example. You put it in your mouth, and you swallow it. Those nutrients enter the stomach. Certain nutrients require, not all require, a certain amount of stomach acid to come in contact with those nutrients to help either separate its different parts. That's what stomach acid would do. So, for example, if you take an herb, which could have hundreds, if not thousands, or tens of thousands of different subcompounds, they need to be broken apart into pieces. And then, if let's say you're eating a steak that has B12 in it, the stomach acid would cleave or break apart the protein component in your stomach from the B12 component. And then the B12 component would eventually get into the small intestine, which is what's next after the stomach. And it's absorbed there with the help of a certain chemical there called intrinsic factor. My point here, which is common to all nutrient absorption in general, at least for the purpose of this conversation, is you eat something, it goes in your stomach, more or less different types of nutrients require more or less stomach acid and stomach enzymes to break them down. And then further digestion of your foods or supplements take place in your small intestine, which is another tube which receives enzymes from the pancreas. So the pancreas is another organ that secretes protein, carbohydrate, and fat digesting enzymes. And without it, we literally could not live. We can live with no stomach acid because the pancreas secretes enzymes that can help us break down foods within the small intestine. But life is not fun. When people take antacids, for example, proton pump inhibitors, which are known as PPI drugs, they tend to shut off or largely shut off their stomach acid because doctors have been told that we don't really need stomach acid to survive, except we know we get all sorts of side effects and problems by not having stomach acid because the stomach is meant to digest foods in certain ways that the pancreas, with its secretions into the small intestine, even though that does assist in further digestion and can make up in many ways for the lack of digestion that may take place in the stomach without stomach acid, it's not the same. So people who take proton pump inhibitors or PPIs may experience malabsorption. They simply may not absorb things well, like calcium. Calcium needs to be acted upon by stomach acid in order for the calcium to become activated so it can be used in the body. It needs to become ionized by stomach acid. When nutrients go through this digestive process from the mouth, down the esophagus, into the stomach, into the small intestine, then absorption of nutrients takes place almost entirely in the small intestine. And the small intestine has a blood supply. And those nutrients from foods that were extracted either from foods or from nutritional supplements are absorbed through various complicated means into the bloodstream. Now, between the stomach and the bloodstream, there is known as the gastro, referring to intestinal tract, hepatic, referring to the liver circulation, the gastrohepatic circulation. Much of the nutrients that we consume get attached to them different carriers. And these carriers are usually different proteins made by the liver. And then these nutrient carriers allows the nutrient to be carried through the bloodstream to specific organs and can then be metabolized in specific ways. So some of those nutrients that you eat and foods that you eat, the important nutritional components make their way to the liver and also make their way to the kidneys. And there is a process of nutrient metabolism, it's called, that take place in the liver and in the kidneys that allow the nutrients to be used properly. Now, along the course of all of that absorption from mouth to end organ location, where you want those nutrients to be, lots of things can go wrong. So before I start the details of this herbal conversation, it is absolutely essential, if you have not ever done this, for you to be assessed, if you're serious about nutrition and your supplements, for your capability of absorbing. What is the general health of your gastrointestinal tract? And the gastrointestinal tract may be working absolutely fine, but oftentimes, in my 27 years of experience, many people have gastrointestinal problems with the use of nutrients in the way I've just talked about, and they don't have any gastrointestinal symptoms at all. Just because an organ does not work well does not mean it produces symptoms. I've talked and explored the concept of health and symptom generation in virtually all of my Ask the Blood Detective shows that you'll find on my blog at blooddetective.com. And what I've tried to emphasize during these shows is that an individual like you may say, no, my intestinal tract is fine. I don't have a problem with absorption or in my gut or my pancreas. But many people do anyway, even without symptoms. And again, as I've said, before there are symptoms in an organ of a problem, there are not symptoms in an organ of a problem. It may take several years, several decades before problems with nutrient utilization show up. And this is very important for you to understand this. The symptoms that might show up in your body from problems that you may have with nutrient absorption, again, from mouth to end organ location, where you want those nutrients to be, the symptoms would be specific, if they show up at all, such that you are aware of them, specific to the organ that did not get the nutrition it needed. So, if you have low stomach acid, a symptom commonly is not stomach problems. The symptom might be you have osteoporosis or osteopenia, which is bone loss that's somewhat less than osteoporosis. So the symptom of malabsorption in you could be your bone loss. It could be your fertility issues. If you do not absorb zinc, if you do not absorb proteins well, if you do not absorb other minerals besides zinc, you might not make viable sperm. You might not have the ideal hormonal balance to perpetuate a healthy pregnancy. If you have a problem in your liver of metabolizing, let's say, folic acid, so that folic acid turns into, that's metabolizing, turns into its usable active form in the body, then you might experience birth defects during pregnancy, cardiovascular disease, stroke potential because of the fact that when you don't activate folic acid, you might be prone to clot formation and getting strokes from clots or what is known as thrombotic strokes. If you don't metabolize tyrosine, an amino acid normally, let's say along with vitamin A and vitamin D, your health problem could be hypothyroidism or low thyroidism that in turn would slow your metabolic rate might raise your blood cholesterol, produce brain fog, fatigue, dry skin, maybe a slight tendency towards constipation, or maybe other symptoms and signs entirely. But my point is that the symptoms you might experience from having a problem with nutrient digestion, absorption, and metabolism, what we're calling using all this stuff, could look like your health problems right now. Arthritis. How is arthritis possibly related to nutrient absorptive problems? Well, if you malabsorb several different key minerals like manganese and zinc, and if you malabsorb or don't activate and utilize best, let's say vitamin C, and if you don't absorb certain amino acids very well, you might then have joint degeneration, which we call arthritis. Now, some of you are thinking, well, for my arthritis, I'm taking glucosamine sulfate. But what if you don't absorb that? What if that's not what you need for your joint decay? So I would advise anyone here who would like to learn more about what it takes for your gastrointestinal tract to work to listen to my show called Everything Digestive, which you'll find on the blog at blooddetective.com. You'll find lots and lots of extremely practical Ask the Blood Detective radio shows on the blog that I have discovered over my decades of experience that you need to know and you very much want to know. People out there are telling me they want to know about nutrient absorption. They want to know about the immune system or immune systems. They want to know how to prevent or delay the onset of cancer and autoimmune diseases and other forms of degenerative diseases experienced by far too large of a segment of the United States and in the world population. So take a look at the blog at blooddetective.com. Now let's talk about herbs. Herbs, like vitamins, minerals, and protein, carbs, and fats, all the different major nutritional components that we should be concerned about, botanicals are an essential player. The extent to which that I see herbs or botanicals, I'll use those terms, or phytonutrients interchangeably, the way that I've seen herbs used by people that work with me is that they will read about herbs or ask someone in the health food store or hear on a radio show that this or that herb can produce a certain health benefit. And most of the time, I fail to be able to confirm that that is what's happening on objective laboratory data or even through detailed questionnaires. You know, someone will say, I've been feeling better than I have in years, and I have them fill out a questionnaire, and they're very surprised at their scoring on my questionnaires because they thought they were healthier than they perceive themselves to be. My role as a healthcare provider and as the blood detective, that again is my badge of honor, is to help those who seek me out feel better, but also to prove that they really are better. The way I do that is I've put together detailed questionnaires called Blood Detective Longevity Questionnaires, which allow you to really look deep into your organ systems. Because if you're asked to grade on a number scale symptoms and issues that you've noticed in different organ systems, when you complete an entire body organ system survey, you will see your body in a way you've never seen it before. And the opportunities to focus in on main issues that have fundamentally some of the same causes. So for example, you've got headaches, yes, and you have dry skin, and you feel that you're aging poorly, and you have some other chronic health problem, let's say high cholesterol. And then through the use of questionnaires, you might find out that all of those problems are because you malabsorb. Most individuals, at least, again, in my experience, are unaware And they have simply have not taken the time out to figure out what they need from a symptom survey point of view. In addition to symptom surveys, when you want to learn how to take herbs, vitamin, minerals, or eating right, you should also have a detailed conversation with a healthcare provider that knows how to ask the right questions to get at hidden or sometimes very blatant answers to your health problems. So when I sit with someone, I review the responses to these questionnaires, and I superimpose that upon my experience with other patients. But then the challenge is always, how do we do things such that the individual knows what they need? That's when laboratory comes in. I will say this right at the onset, if you remember nothing else from this laboratory conversation, please remember this, is that laboratory cannot and does not accurately check nutrient levels in every case. In fact, in most cases, the levels of nutrients, a blood zinc level, a plasma zinc level, a serum magnesium level, a plasma vitamin A level, these are not necessarily accurate levels for your intake and body's balance over the course of anything more than a few days. What I'm saying also is that you might have a level of a nutrient, let's say vitamin C in your blood, but that doesn't mean that vitamin C is in your heart tissue or is idealized in your thyroid tissue or your thyroid gland. So because testing has limitations, although it has many advantages too, we want to correlate as many different factors, questionnaires, reviewing those questionnaires, getting clear on your goals, getting clear on your current state of health, selecting different laboratory tests that will match your needs better, and those tests should be read in context with all else that we're doing during an intake. And then, usually by the second time I meet with an individual, I'm making most or many major suggestions in terms of lifestyle, foods, nutritional supplements. By that time, once there has been a thorough review of laboratory work, often laboratory work that was performed outside of my office, many people have dozens of pages, inches of pages worth of prior testing, and there's so much gold in those tests that most people are not aware of that can be used for their health. It's very shocking to me. So I commonly do see people that have explored their health, done the right tests, and they simply have not been told the right information. But one more concept before we move on to herbs is that there are tests that are called things like ferritin and fibrinogen and C-reactive protein and homocysteine and CRP standard. These sorts of tests and many others tell us a lot about nutritional needs, even though they are not tests of nutrition levels. So this is a very sophisticated area. As an author of a 500-page laboratory book called The Encyclopedia of Anti-Aging Tests, I can tell you that even for health professionals of all types, I have physicians, medical physicians reading my book and using its concepts to interpret their patients' laboratory work, nutritionally speaking, osteopaths, nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and others. Because this is a very hard topic. It's so hard, even I know it's hard, for me, that I've invented a software program called Blood Logic, which allows me to produce detailed patient and practitioner reports of the medical nutritional meaning of many hundreds of pieces of lab data all at once. And then once my computer system is done reviewing things, I then overread that. And that gives me an extremely solid foundation for nutritional needs. There simply is no way for an individual who does not use technology to do as thorough of a job as when they use computer-generated technology like Blood Logic. So I produce these reports for my patients, and then when I give them food advice or nutritional supplement advice, it's based on, again, many dozens of key factors of their biochemistry. Then my experience overreading that, connecting it with questionnaires, and then trial and error, folks. You are not a textbook. What I say to some individuals that see me, and I mean it every time, is that we need to literally write the book on you, comparing yourself to you over time. So if we want to personalize and idealize a nutritional approach for any individual, there will be a trial and error period. You try this, we make an adjustment, but let's say we have you take a certain amount of echinacea, which is an immune-modulating nutrient. Potentially, if it's taken right in a particular individual, the dose of echinacea, you can't check a blood level, that doesn't exist, but there are other organs that are affected potentially by echinacea, so you look at those types of tests, and then you look at the symptom questionnaire and what improves there too. Over a long enough period of time, we need to see that a person is improving. I'm going to say this again, it's important. Over a long enough period of time for us to know the positive effects are not imagined, because the mind is powerful, folks. We all know this. So if you take echinacea, for example, or any herb or any vitamin, mineral, or food that you want it to help, that you want it to help a certain problem, you might experience an improvement in that situation for a week, a month, or 2 months, simply because you wanted it to happen. And that is a necessary part of the healing response. We want to use that. That's not imagined. I mean, you're feeling better. But if we can have you feel better and we can fix certain abnormalities and we can improve upon your symptom surveys, your questionnaire scores, the higher the score, let's say the worse you are off in terms of symptoms and perceived problems. If we can reduce that score, if we can improve those tests, then we're really getting somewhere. So let's move on to herbs or botanicals. So we know that in the United States, all these herbal products are sold as dietary supplements. And there are certain labeling guidelines that are required for all of these different supplements. And also, if you've ever purchased any herbal product, sometimes the herbs are sold as a single supplement, or they're combined in the form of formulations. So the botanical might have some vitamins mixed in there with it, some extra minerals or other nutrients, even some other herbs. And let's face it, you're taking these herbs because you want a therapeutic or health-promoting effect of these herbs. People don't usually use herbs. I don't think I've even seen this once. They're not using herbs for general basic nutrition. They're usually using herbs to supplement beyond the basics, because they have a particular health problem that they want the herb or herbs they're taking to target. And again, the thing about herbs, which is amazing, is that the historical use of herbs or herbals as therapeutic agents is rooted in nearly every ancient culture. There's written evidence of advanced medicinal systems using herbal medicine in some of the earliest writings in both Western and Eastern culture. You know, such as traditional Chinese medicine or TCM, Ayurveda, which was developed in India. And there's also the eclectic and modern herbalist movements of Europe and the Americas. And each of these traditions, and there are many other adaptations of them, rely upon different diagnostic philosophies, different botanical ingredients in their products. There are differences in how they prepare things and also how they provide the doses. I won't be able to review all the different cultural aspects of the use of herbals. It's just too short of a show. I mean, and that could take years, literally. So I can only just cover the basics of how botanical products are prepared, their different forms, how they might be standardized, how they could be contaminated, how they could be mixed together and concentrated. These are the basic concepts that I'll be reviewing right now. I will say this, as far as the use of herbs, herbs must be based on the individual, and we need to go beyond just symptom relief, particularly if someone is taking one or more herbs to get rid of specific health problems. Certainly, whether it's cancer prevention, chronic fatigue, headaches, chronic gastrointestinal problems, chronic hormonal problems. Objective evidence that the herb is really working is absolutely essential. A very common philosophy in the United States, I should mention, of herbal use is that you should take herbs for a certain number of months. Sometimes I've heard 3 months, sometimes I've heard 6 months, 8 months, a handful of months, several months, and then stop them so that your body doesn't rely on them or some similar type of philosophy. I have researched this concept and talked to many individuals like myself who are herbalists and deal with herbs, their opinion, and not a single one of them could tell me where that saying was derived, where they heard the fact that you take herbs for a bit of time, then you stop them and you, in other words, you cycle them. See, I personally do not believe in generalizations, particularly those that cannot be proven. Herbs are plants, plants are foods in many cases, and herbs are concentrates of these plants. And then each herb or herbal combinations are, they carry, I should say, the potential of enhancing the ability of organs to repair themselves. Many herbs themselves are anti-inflammatory. Other herbs and herbal combinations are immune modulators, meaning if the immune system is low, it can help bring the immune system higher. If the immune system is higher, it brings it down low. Now, some of you out there who know a little bit or maybe a lot about herbs are thinking, wait a second, Dr. Wald, I have heard that herbs are immune boosters. Echinacea, astragalus, a golden seal, for example, those are three common ones that are thought to be immune boosters. And my doctor said that I have an autoimmune disease, too much immune system that's not working, and I should not take immune boosters. But herbs are really adaptogens. Herbs are foods and they provide certain nutritional compounds that help organs regulate themselves. So if the organ is hyperfunctioning, it can potentially come down. If the organ is hypofunctioning, is in a low state of health, it could come up. So herbs regulate. They're not immune boosters. They don't push you in just one way necessarily. This is an example of a common misconception. There's a lot of these misconceptions I find in herbal and nutritional healthcare. The point is, we have to see what's appropriate for you. Now, when botanicals or herbal ingredients are used as dietary supplements, they're used in all sorts of ways. And the same goes for different vitamins and minerals. They can be sold as dried plants or plant parts. They can be sifted and cut. They're in dried powder form, liquid extracts, powdered extracts, standardized powdered extracts as well. And they can be made into capsules or tablets that are compressed. And these different forms can provide different and unique opportunities for the use of the herbal contents. So for example, if I want to help improve someone's absorption and I have evidence that they have malabsorption in the small intestine and loss of the absorptive cells in the intestinal tract, I might want a liquid tincture herbal product that contains herbs that help reduce inflammation and revitalize the intestinal cells, I might give that as a liquid so the liquid can coat a larger surface area in the small intestine. But another fallacy that people tell me about is they think that all liquid nutrient products, whether they're herbs or other nutraceuticals, are simply better because they're liquids. If the quality of the herb is poor, or the herb or herbal combinations are just not right for you, even though they're in a liquid form, they're still not right for you in a liquid form. So liquids do carry certain potentials theoretically, but there's other factors that go into whether or not those herbals are correct for you. Now, one of the most common ways to deliver herbal ingredients besides consuming them directly in the form of the herb is by using water extracts, you know, like an infusion tea. It's simply made by pouring boiling water over, you know, dried herbal preparations and steeping and then straining them. And then there's what's known as a decoction, which is similar, and that requires subjecting the herbal material to boiling water over a much longer period of time before you cool it and you strain it. And infusions, by the way, are common for leaves and flowers, while decoctions are usually made from denser parts of the plants, from their berries, their bark, or their roots. So most often, the packaging of the herb will tell you how to prepare it. And that's based on some information regarding how to best extract the nutritional contents of the herbs. So when I choose what forms of herbs or nutrients to use with an individual, it needs to be based on what part of the plant, what part of the herb contains more or less of the ingredients that I want the individual to get. And then I choose the proper form of the herb, but it has to be in context with what the patient can manage. Even if the patient should be consuming, let's say, capsules or powdered form of herbs, they might be too sick for that. Their gastrointestinal tract may not be healthy enough, and I might have to use liquid forms. I might also mix up dried forms of the herb and put them in certain carrier creams, which can take some of these herbs through the skin, delivering them right into the bloodstream. You don't hear about that much. Transdermal nutrition, as it's called, is the process of using nutrition on the skin. I use this a lot with older individuals, people with gastrointestinal tracts that are beyond repair, and also children, of course, or just individuals who have malabsorption issues, and certain nutrients can just be put on the skin. Not all nutrients and not all herbs will go through the skin, but quite a lot will if combined with the proper carriers. And then there are tinctures and liquid extracts of herbs, and these liquid extracts are made by soaking or percolating the smashed up or macerated herb in either water or ethyl alcohol, both of which serve as a solvent. So the ratio of plant material to solvent, the strength and type of the solvent, and the length of time of extraction, all of this is usually determined by the traditional use of the plant, the nature of the plant constituents being extracted, and whatever desired potency a practitioner wants for the final extract. There's much more I can say about tinctures and liquids, but I want to cover a little bit about powdered extracts. Now, powdered extracts are super common, and powdered extracts start out as liquid extracts that are made by evaporating the water or the solvent. And depending on the nature of the herb or the plant, a carrier is often added to the material to allow it to maintain what's known as a free-flowing, characteristics. And then there is something known as standardized extracts. This is the one that is probably among the most important of all of the different types, if not the most important way of herbal manufacturing and production. So standardized extracts, here's what we have. We have liquid or powdered extracts that are manufactured to contain a specific amount or of one or more of the ingredients in the herbs. So standardized extracts, they're usually described as a percentage of the different compounds on the bottle. So the constituents used for standardization are usually those that are very unique to the plant itself being extracted. And the balance of the standardized ingredients, in other words, what's in the plant, how much should be there, like who figures that out, that's usually based on or related to the traditional medicinal use of the plant. I like to start out often with standardized extracts because I simply know what I'm getting. There are many studies that use a particular herb, or most often they might take a specific content of the herb and they standardize it. So they know exactly how much of that herb helps, let's say, reduce the growth rate of prostate or breast cancer cells, or reduce metastatic spread, or improve a certain aspect of the immune system, or reduce a certain form of inflammation. So I like standardized extracts. There's a lot of controversy out there where there are those herbalists who say that some use standard herbal extracts, some use all the different types of herbal preparation that I've mentioned, and many others that I do not have time to mention today. And then there are others who believe that the plant itself should be used and the ingredients should not be standardized because nature knows how to put things together in a certain specific way. Well, I understand that concept, but I still have a problem with it because nature may know and often does know how to produce, let's say, an herbal product with a certain amount of ratioed contents in a certain way, but the individual may require something very different than that. Also, if I want a specific effect of, let's say, for example, reducing lymphatic inflammation so that cancer cells don't leak out of lymphatic channels, and I know that there's an herb in bilberry, and a specific compound, I should say, in the herb bilberry that has been shown to do that at a certain concentration in a large population of people, I want that standardized compound within that herb. I simply don't want bilberry because I don't know how much bilberry is in that particular plant that I'm consuming compared to the next non-standardized capsule, tincture, or whatever form of bilberry I might be taking. So the point is here, folks, that sometimes I will start out with standardized compounds. I will then get a standardized form of a particular herbal ingredient that I might need for specific effects. I might need 10, 20, 30 different types of compounds. But if I want those compounds, I need those compounds. I have to be able to count on those compounds being in the product. So I'm not very comfortable using non-standardized forms of herbs unless they're taken in addition to the intake of standardized forms. So because I am known as the blood detective, and because I'm looking at laboratory on individuals, and I want specific desired effects beyond just the person saying, hey, I feel better today. I took Feverfew, my headache went away. Isn't that great? Yes, Feverfew has been studied to work, but you need a few hundred milligrams of standardized Feverfew over usually a period of time for that to make a difference in the underlying ways in which, let's say, migraines might happen. I had started to say that if a person does consume, let's say, teas, which are very weak forms of herbal supplementation that have ingredients in them that I would like for one of my patients, let's say, I allow that. That's fine, probably, but not instead of a very strong base of standardized herbs. You know, the Food and Drug Administration makes the claim that they have issues with the supplement industry in many areas because of the lack of standardization. I happen to agree with them. So, for example, there's standardization in medications, and regular physicians, and I'm generalizing here, forgive me, I'm just trying to make a point, might not want their patients to take a non-standardized form, let's say, of thyroid hormone replacement. One form is Nature Thyroid or Armour Thyroid, and there are other forms of natural thyroid hormone because they are not standardized. That's like taking a different strength pill of hormone supplementation every day when you take it. And that can cause a lot of endocrine or hormonal confusion and adverse feedback in the body. So it's important, I believe, that standardization represent a fundamental part of anyone's use of natural medicine or natural health. So when we're using standardized extracts, it's essential. It is so important to be able to correlate the type of the extract used in successful clinical trials. You know, what dose did they use in those trials for cancer and those studies for heart disease? You name the problem. Think of your health problems. The herbs that you use should be based on successful clinical trials in terms of their dose, the extraction solvent used, how they standardize it. You know, in many cases, successful clinical trials will have used a plant's powder, a dilute liquid extract, a concentration of the juice, or some other preparation. Most herbal preparations used in clinical trials today, they're well characterized, and they will often be standardized extracts of the botanical. They'll be standardized. That's what you want. So most clinical trials using herbal preparations today are very well characterized and will often use standardized extracts of the botanicals that have a long history of successful use as a non-standardized ingredient in the hands of healers trained in the use of them. But we know more now. We are more scientific. So it's important to note that the successful use of a standardized herb does not negate any previous published research or traditional use of the botanical. Let me say that in English. There are positive scientific studies on the use of standardized herbs and just herbal preparations, and there are not successful scientific studies. It behooves the healthcare provider to go through these scientific studies and to see which ones relate best to their patients. But just because some study might come out tomorrow that says herbs don't work, there are many studies that say herbs do work in certain circumstances at certain doses for specific populations of people. It's always, folks, it's always the preponderance of evidence that needs to be considered. Many practitioners, particularly those that don't know herbology, if they hear that there's a negative study about some herb, they might even know the name of the herb, let's say feverfew again, and they might extrapolate that all herbs don't work. So this is a characteristic of human beings to generalize, and that is a very, very dangerous attitude, one that most people do not know they're doing when they are in fact doing it. Anyone interested in herbs, let me say that again, anyone interested in herbs must be interested in whether or not they are contaminated. When herbs are produced and manufactured, they're dried, sometimes out in the sun, they could accumulate fungal organisms which stay with the herb all through the manufacturing process. So I want to make sure that a person who's taking herbs has normal stomach acid where they can break down various toxic candida or other types of fungal organisms and plants, using herbs that first and foremost have been tested for their fungal content and also the concentration of heavy metals. This is a big deal. Herbs, first of all, can have very toxic compounds contained in them, like heavy metals, mercury, lead, aluminum, and there are many others. So it's important that at least I check the excretion of what are known as free metals in the urine. Some of you are thinking, I've had metals tests, I've had 24-hour provocation metals testing. Others of you are saying, what is he talking about? There are right and wrong tests for how metals are checked in individuals. And one very common problem of herbs is that they can contain heavy metals, which can inflict a far more damage on the body than any health potential of the herb. So when we're taking herbs, we do our questionnaires, our health questionnaires. We check our blood levels of all the different body systems, let's say. We do a body composition test, which tells me your metabolic rate, so I know how you burn calories, so I have another idea of how to dose herbs with you. I then use standardized herbs along with other nutrient compounds that are non-herbal, vitamins, minerals, protein, carbs, fats, whatever the food suggestions might be, to figure out how all of this should be done together so it's easier on people, not harder. So we also want to add to that list of considerations for proper herbal use is metals testing. Let me say it again, metals testing. You do not want to be doing 24-hour testing that uses a drug like DMSA or DMPS or EDTA because they will pull metals out of anyone. And every one of us has some small amount of metals in us. So the test can give us a false presumption that we're heavy metal toxic. So there are a combination of tests that give us comfort about whether or not someone's getting too much metals from either their environment, which would then include their herbs that they're taking for their health. Very important to screen over time about metals. Heavy metals can perpetuate virtually any health problem. They lower immunity. You can be more susceptible to infections. You can have chronic Lyme disease because you have an immune system that's stressed because of the metals. It's complicated. But it does not have to be when you're working with the right person and really just taking your time to do it right. So the last concept I want to leave you with is that herbs are best used when they're used as part of a thought-out healing effort, a thought-out healing approach that includes some of the things I was talking about today, not merely just going to a health food store, grabbing an herb, and merely using it. So I want to thank everyone for joining me today on Ask the Blood Detective. What I'll do on the next show is talk about specific standardized herbs and all kinds of health problems from A to Z that you can avoid potentially by taking these herbs or at least offset your risk of getting them. To reach me, please give me a call at 914-552-1442, 914-552-1442, if you'd like to work with me on your health. Email me your show topics at info@blooddetective.com. I love getting feedback from you guys. It's how I determine the topics of the shows. So again, my name is Dr. Michael Wald, known as the Blood Detective. Reach me at 914-552-1442 and come see me in my office in Mount Kisco and look at my blog for all of my free lectures coming up, including my free holistic breakfast on November 11th. Take care, everyone. I've done.